OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. The views on this podcast are our own and are intended for information and educational purposes only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of sex and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
Another fantastic episode coming up.
We say this every time.
I know, but
they
keep getting better.
So on this episode, we are joined with Gavin, who is an occupational therapist as well as a trans man. And he is discussing his experience with transition, his personal experience, as well as the opportunities for occupational therapy practitioners to assist with individuals in their transition.
Sit back and enjoy this episode.
So welcome. Today we are here with Gavin, who is an occupational therapist and also a trans man. Welcome, Gavin, to OT After Dark.
Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
So why don't you kind of give us a little bit of background about you know, you and your career as an occupational therapist and everything.
Mm-hmm. So I am a new occupational therapist. I graduated in May during the midst of all this craziness. I also have transitioned while in graduate school, which if anybody and people who are listening who have gone through graduate school know how much of a feat that is. So add transitioning on top of it. Burning the candles at both end there a little bit, but it was good. I have medically, legally, and socially transitioned, which I think is important to explain that there are different sets of a transition that occur. So the first transition that I underwent was a social transition, which is when I had to come out to all of my friends, family, my program, to get my name changed and get everything in set there. A legal transition when I had to legally change my name and legally change my assigned gender at birth. And then a medical transition where I'm currently on hormone replacement therapy and I have had some gender affirming surgeries so far.
So can we start and focus in on that, the social transition and mm-hmm. how that played out for you?
Yeah. So this social transition was a really interesting part of my transition. Earlier on, before I was looking like I do now, so the term that they use is passable, which means that you pass for the gender that you know that you are. I was not passing. So I still looked very feminine and had a very high voice and very feminine features. And so when I started to come out socially, even being in a very progressive area in the Northeast, right outside of New York City, I was still met with a lot of backlash and a lot of issues from people Some based out of just truly not knowing what or who a transgender person is, what that means. Some of it just being like hate-based or fear-based and really kind of like attacking me. And some of it just being complete non-acceptance because I wasn't looking or sounding like how I knew I wanted to look and sound, and other people had a really difficult time conceptualizing that. But I tried to work on, I had some really wonderful and supportive friends while I was working through it with my family and with a couple of other close friends, and just how my professional life was going to change as I started to assume the role as a man, which is very interesting. It's a lot different than being a woman in space. Being a man taking up space has some differences, which I was kind of surprised about.
Tell us.
People give me more room on the train. Like, they won't sit right next to me, or they'll help me when I walk into an auto body shop instead of just like letting me run free through it. They like hunt me down. Like, I'm supposed to magically know what I'm talking about now. So definitely some like weird aspects, and even a little bit weird socially wise being a practitioner. Mm-hmm. I've had people actually be kinder to me and make, unfortunately, comments about how I'm, you know, so much smarter than a female counterpart or something like that. And I'm like, if you only knew. So definitely very interesting socially to transition.
That'd be interesting. And that whole male versus female smarter in therapy land is sadly common.
Yes, unfortunately alive and well.
Yeah.
Now I get to benefit from it, I guess, which is nice that I'm getting some benefits out of it. But it definitely has brought light to a lot of things that I knew were always there gender-wise, but would never know until I had that experience of firsthand experience.
Yeah.
Of being in that position.
That's me. I feel like that's a whole separate conversation,
right?
Separate research project almost.
Yes. A lot of this, I was thinking about just coming onto this podcast and what direction I even wanted to go in. And it was I've been wrestling with it for weeks, just being like, this is so genuinely complicated. Mm-hmm. The transition and what it's done for my life, from personal to professional and everywhere in between, has been astronomical and insanely difficult. And all my own experience, like a lot of the times when you start interacting with transgender people, they'll be very, very specific about saying, this is my experience, mm-hmm. and what I have gone through, because each person experiences something so vastly different. Like, I grew up basically in the basement of a church. So a lot of my transition was getting over like the most vile hatred the Christian church had to offer, mm-hmm. and having to like reverse those ideals and truths and pillars in my life. So there's a lot of like a mental component that came along with it in my experience, which was very difficult. But it's been something that I've been able to work through, and had a great clinical care team to help me along the way. Mm-hmm. So I also have a clinical care team just out there. Like, I have a social worker, a talk therapist, like a psychotherapist, mm-hmm. Nurse practitioner, doctor, surgeon, and a couple of other people who are tracking my health throughout this whole thing, mm-hmm. as well.
Was that difficult to find that team, or where you live, was that kind of not uncommon to find?
Thankfully, the universe really opened its door for me. I was in New York City going to a support group, and I went to this one community health group that's known for helping LGBT people. And I went up to the desk and I said, I love a pamphlet on how to start testosterone. Like, is there some sort of resource or pamphlet that you can give me that I can start looking into hormone replacement therapy? And all of a sudden I was filling out paperwork and getting signed on as a patient that day because it was the end of their fiscal year and their nonprofit. So I have had all of my medical care be covered.
Nice.
Outside That's of insurance. Great. So I've never paid for prescriptions or blood work or anything like that until I was an adult and had to move out of that program. But I thankfully was given this team kind of on a silver platter.
Yeah.
That door was opened for me. And
but you didn't really actually helped. You didn't actually know that team necessarily existed when that. That's interesting. I was on a call last week. So in where we live, there's three major hospital systems. One mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with having, they have an LGBTQ clinic. They have a whole like trans care team that's very, like everybody knows. Mm-hmm. I was surprised on the call that the two other major hospitals had the same thing. It's just not really publicized that much, which I thought right. was interesting.
And it's something that I wish was more public knowledge. Mm-hmm. Like I wish people understood that one, there are clinical care teams out there for transgender people, but two, that it does take an entire care mm-hmm. team. It's not just, you know, one morning you wake up and you're like, I have decided to transition. No, it's very complicated mm-hmm. and there's so many steps yeah. to get to where I am today. Mm-hmm. You know, years of medical intervention and everything else. So I hope that with this, at least starting to get out there, that if someone hears it on the podcast, that they can help patients or someone in their life who's looking for a clinical care team, knowing that they are out there mm-hmm. Yeah. somewhere.
And with your experience with the clinical care team and your background as an occupational therapist, you know, do you see or where is the role for occupational therapy within this clinical care team in this context?
Great question. So there is an astronomical amount of things that I'm already, you know, panning through in my head and going down. An occupational therapist, I would say, one of the first major things we could do would be like assistive devices or equipment. So there is a couple of different things that is available for trans men. The first being what's called a binder, which is a compression garment for the chest to have a flatter appearing chest to the public, which is a matter of one, personal preference, but two, safety. It's something that we, you know, need to start thinking about as a part of keeping our patients safe and ensuring that in public, you know, you never quite know who you're going to interact with. And unfortunately, there's a lot of hatred towards trans people right now. So there's a need for this adaptive equipment. There's also something called an STP, which stands for stand to pee device, which is a device that can be used in a men's restroom so that you can stand instead of sitting. So you can use a urinal instead of sitting. And then there's a whole array of prosthetics for sex, bringing it to sex, that there's plenty of equipment and things to use in the bedroom to help people overcome gender dysphoria and maybe the disconnect they're having between the sex that they're having and the sex they want to be having.
Can we talk a little bit? I have a question about binders. Mm-hmm. Or binding. I've always heard that it can be really unsafe if it's done wrong, but I don't fully understand like what goes wrong, what the safe way is, what the not safe way is. Could you speak a little to that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So binding can be extremely unsafe. Compressing the rib cage and anywhere in that area starts making it more difficult for those intercostal muscles to expand. So when you wear something like an ACE bandage, that is meant to constrict and be super tight. So that can be very damaging to the ribs and the muscles. They learn and get that kind of dependency. So it makes it more difficult to breathe. And when you're not getting so much oxygen, that's really bad when you're starting to do, you know, like exercising. So something that's so difficult is like going to the gym as a trans person, because I used to have very large breasts. I had double D breasts. And so I had to choose when I was going to the gym between being safe and wearing a sports bra or something less compressing, mm-hmm. or wearing a binder and knowing that my health is at risk. My breathing's going to be down. I'm more likely to pass out. I'm more likely to get some sort of skin irritation and skin integrity because it's rubbing on the sides and being close and sweaty. And depending on your access or availability to binders, if this is one of your only, like your only binder, you might be wearing it for days on end before you get to wash it. And so whatever's growing or building up inside of the sweatiness of a binder can be also dangerous. So there's a couple of different reasons that it can be dangerous. And obviously in those moments, you're wearing this horribly uncomfortable thing to conceal. So if you're going to go on a scale of being uncomfortable, like if I'm going to be uncomfortable, it doesn't matter if I'm uncomfortable on a scale of like 3 or if I'm 10 uncomfortable, if I'm not achieving that look that I want, I'm going to keep pushing myself into that discomfort to present how I want to present to the world and be safe. But I highly encourage that be something practitioners know too, like you should be binding 8 hours a day or less is a good start. So that's something to think about. Like if patients are on shifts and they have to be working for 12 hour mm-hmm. shifts, well, what are you going to do? Because it's not technically safe to be binding that many hours out of the day. And just knowing they're like, some people try to wear theirs to sleep. Well, it's not good to wear it to sleep because that's pushing how many hours a day you're binding. And then any physical exercise is not good to do while binding. So that limits you in a lot of areas. And I remember even, you know, binding on my way to class one time and having to run because I was running late, and you can't really be late in grad school. They're not too happy about that. And I remember by the time I got there, I was like, that wasn't even worth it. Like I had to stand outside of class and compose myself and just try to catch my breath for so long, but I couldn't because I couldn't expand my lungs all the way. And it just was so difficult to catch my breath and get back on to normal breathing patterns.
Information we need. That's and where, you know, are there places that you are able to get these resources and this information, or, you know, was, you know, your clinical care team able to provide you with some of this information on how to safely do some of these things, or what did that look like?
Mostly my own research. So mostly it was me being very involved in the community and getting involved in Facebook groups and getting involved in other social media platforms, because unfortunately, a lot of the quote unquote research that I have pulled to make all of these giant medical decisions have been from other trans people. There's not much research on anything involving transgender people. So unfortunately, a lot of this information is coming from people who have lived the experience and are now taking the time to pass on the information to other people. I was given some information from my clinical care team, but nothing like what other people in the community have provided for me.
Do you see a place for MOT or OTD students doing research or doctoral capstones to kind of gather more information, more solid information on this?
Yeah, I think that there's so much room for research and moving forward, and especially in these kinds of programs where we can start really exploring what occupational therapy can do. It, you know, even thinking about it, I was like, well, you know, what could OT do? And I'm like, well, they could do so much, but we haven't even begun to really open those doors as a profession that I find myself like starting to open it. And it feels like I'm opening the floodgates. I'm like, I can't even just peek in. I can't look around the corner or see what's coming. It's like, oh, well, now there's that whole flood of everything else that's coming in. That makes it a little bit difficult to like, but I think, yes, there's so much room for so much research. And I'm hoping we will see that trend over the next couple of years.
I hope so too. That's my hope. Where I work is especially with the doctoral capstones. I really want to see and capstones focusing on many areas related to sex and gender, but this specifically, I think there's so much to do, even if it's just like, I mean, the fact that there's no concrete information about like binding and how, what's safe, what's like in terms of time, if that 8 hours, if you're getting that just from like general consensus among people, it sounds like, it seems like we need much more concrete information on it.
Right. And, you know, I'm sure someone has done some small variation of it, but it needs to be done on a much larger scale.
And who knows, there could be stuff that's just unpublished too. Anything else in terms of, I know you mentioned the equipment related to sex, like anything specific that you think OT practitioners need to know when either helping a client who's new to it or helping a client that has some new, you know, maybe they were fine using and now they can't, like, what do we need to know?
That the options are vast. That, like, which isn't a great way to kind of narrow it in, but I have done a significant amount of my research and pull into these different devices and different things available on the market, and that there is a huge variation in what you can get. So if there's not a lot of access to money or there's not a lot of access to resources, there are still options available for those clients. So you can get products that are $10, $15, something a lot more manageable. And then you get to the higher end prosthetics that are ranging you closer to $1,000 to $2,000. So that there is a very, very vast range. And depending on, you know, sometimes it is bang for your buck. So if you have a little bit more money, but that's like with any equipment we offer, you know, if it's more expensive, there's usually a reason, a little bit more function, a little difference. And that there's a wide variety of things. So you can have a packer, and a packer is just an item that's used, someone can put in their pants to help them with feeling like they have the appropriate genitalia that they would want to have. You can then move up to an STP, which only is to pee. You can move to like a 2-in-1 or a 3-in-1. So some of them vary. Some of them are like multifunctional, where they can be a stand to pee device and a device that's used for sex. So it's really about maybe like having the resources to say, well, here's a couple of companies that you can look into that sell these products, and you can kind of start exploring more of what you're looking for. I would highly recommend like YouTube videos that give product recommendations that are done by other trans people about their experience with said product. That helps significantly in the research process. But that there's always another option, I would say, is an important thing to remember. There's always something else to try out, something new coming to the market. That's something that's been really cool is the market has been expanding even since I've been transitioning, and new companies are starting up and creating items for different functional purposes, whereas one might be really good for one and not, you know, a different function. It kind of depends on what an individual is looking for.
And that's what we have a lot of research and for various things. And I think, even reading reviews is what we've probably learned most about and other things. Every stand to pee review, that practice in the shower first.
Oh yes,
every single
definitely
one.
Practice in the shower first. And that's another thing too, is that accidents can happen, and having people be prepared and ready for said if something goes wrong, if it's jostled wrong, if it does something, unfortunately, being prepared is a necessity when starting to move into that.
Which
kind
are
of work.
Really good
I
things.
Could never get the hang of it, so I have dropped that ship completely.
Yeah.
It was so difficult. I tried so many. It just was something I could never quite figure out. So I commend people who can do it, but it is definitely difficult to do.
And I think these are the kind of things that OT practitioners need to know about and need to mm-hmm. be comfortable with discussing mm-hmm. and exploring. So the legal transition, can you mm-hmm. speak to that?
Yes. So I had to legally change my name, which involved going in front of a judge and making my case for why my name should be changed, which is mostly to make sure that you're like not evading taxes or child support. But it was still a very, very taxing moment in my life because you have to publish in the paper that you're legally changing your name in case anyone wants to show up to the hearing and refuse your name change, which gave me a lot of anxiety. Yeah. Because I didn't know if anyone would show up. And in the times that we were in, it was not exactly mm-hmm. Safe in the universe for me. And so I had to publish it in the paper and then go in front of the judge and then publish it again in the paper to make it official and get the official court documents, which then led to a very complicated process of changing it at the Social Security office, the DMV, every loan I've ever taken now. The university relations, doctor's appointments, dentist appointments, Dunkin' Donuts rewards cards, like everything you do almost uses your name. Mm-hmm. And it's a very big deal to go around and change it. And unfortunately, it was not always the easiest either. Some people have very rude comments, very destructive things to say, like the DMV, the woman was like, why would you even transition? Like, you know, that's not right. And I was like, thank you for your irrelevant opinion, but I'm gonna keep doing what I need to do. And just, you know, like I had a big push too to change my name before I graduated with my undergraduate degree so that my degree was also in mm-hmm. my name, which was something kind of concerning getting to that moment and making sure I had that flip beforehand. And then I also had to legally change my gender marker, which involved having medical documentation from my clinical care team, explaining that I had undergone the necessary surgeries to be considered someone who can change their little gender marker on their birth certificate from F to M. But that in itself was a bit of gatekeeping, that I had to get surgery and be on hormones for however long mm-hmm. I needed to do that. I don't recall off the top of my head before being able to transition all that stuff over, which then meant going back to the Social Security office and the DMV and anywhere and everywhere that takes a gender marker. So in reverse, that everywhere as well. So that was my legal transition.
How was, I'm especially interested in the university. How was the process of doing that at your?
Luckily, it was very smooth. My program was wonderful about it, and they switched everything for me before I did anything legally. So they kind of had me doing and whatever, but the university thankfully did not say much. That was something I was concerned about because I went to a private Catholic institution, which is not notoriously the most accepting place to be doing this. But I just went to registrar and they didn't give me a problem.
Good to hear.
Great.
Yeah, yes. Hearing that.
But even that, like I had to go back and be kind of, I'd ask them for like new ID because my ID wouldn't swipe me into the men's locker room in the gym. Mm. And so there was parts of that. And like, I had to beg them to switch my photo from freshman year because I was like, I don't quite look like this anymore. Like, maybe can I get a new photo? And they're like, we don't usually do that, but I guess so. And I was like, thank you for your generosity.
Like, that's really interesting to hear that an ID, it makes total sense. It never occurred to me that an ID would be linked to gender for where you can and can't go.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
So that was very interesting.
Huh. Well, now I want to look more into that. How many places are doing that?
So then how about the medical transition?
So I started hormone replacement therapy like a month before I started grad school. So I have to self-administer testosterone shots. I currently take them subcutaneously, which means in my stomach. I have taken them in like intramuscular, which is a giant needle into your thigh, but I decided to move away from that because it was a little scary. But that felt like a little bit of the universe like poking fun at me because needles were my biggest fear, and now I have to give myself my own shot every single week.
Is there a significant difference between the subcutaneous and the like?
Yes.
Why
so
you decide either
the
way?
Needle size is different. Okay. The needle for my intramuscular shot was an inch and a half long, mm-hmm. and my subcutaneous needle is half an inch.
Is there any difference in results?
They don't know.
Okay.
Per se, they recommend. At least the clinic that I went to recommended staying intramuscular for as long as you can, because that's how most people administer to start off with. But I chose to switch to subcutaneous, and they just had to watch my levels really closely. So they track my testosterone levels in my blood and my liver levels and a couple of other of those random things that secondary sex hormones do interfere with. And so they had to watch, and my dose changed as it like moved to a different area of the body.
Okay. So one of those many areas where more research is needed. One of those many areas where more research is needed.
Exactly. Yes. That's something that's definitely interesting, because there's also the ability to take it topically, which would be a daily pump of lotion that you put onto your skin, but you unfortunately can transfer that testosterone from your skin before it dries to animals or people around you. So there are pros and cons to different administration methods, but those are the three most common in the United States right now. So yes, I take a shot weekly, and I also have, there's a lot of side effects with that, a lot of changes, a lot of differences. And something I kind of wanted to talk about was how my emotions changed being on testosterone. So in my experience, I had a very interesting physiological change with how I felt emotions. So whereas, you know, maybe before when I felt angry, I would know because my ears would get hot, or I would get some cue from the body that would let me know how I'm feeling, or if I had anxiety, like my chest would constrict or something like that. But those changed for me, actually, as I started hormone therapy and started going through my second puberty. And so I had to relearn emotional regulation with these new body responses while in grad school, which like was very stressful to not know how I was feeling in the most stressful time of my life, and like trying to navigate those ropes and act appropriately and know that sometimes like I felt like a 14-year-old boy and I wanted to react and be crazy like a prepubescent individual does or feels, but I also knew that I was 22 and couldn't act out in the ways that testosterone was making me feel. Because there's a bit of a change moving into that, and you do go through this whole second puberty. So if I, in my mind, how I kind of saw it is I was starting at like 13 years old at my transition. And so moving through this, like I've only been on testosterone for 3.5 years about. And I would say just started teetering off of that really high energy, really high sex drive, really high things that a lot of cis men we see going through high school experience.
Did your clinical team prepare you for that?
I don't think anyone can prepare
for
it, because everyone experiences something so different. Yeah. So I know that my experience is not similar to my friend's experience. which also is very impactful by what age you start hormones. Mm-hmm. So I had a friend who started at 13, so that gave a very different experience than for me, who started at 21.
Did they acknowledge that something, that it might happen, that there might be emotional issues? Was that part of before you went on testosterone, or you just kind of figured it out for yourself completely?
That was told, no, they basically said to me that that was not going to happen, actually. It was very hard, like, that's not how this works. But in my experience, I noticed a big difference. And granted, it could be a couple of factors. So I don't too well with sensory input. I have like a little deficit on my sensory profile. And so binding just made me so angry, like all the time. And so I had to bind for my mental health, but then it would also make me more aggravated and just a little snappier, and then add some testosterone into that mix. And it's like a wildfire. It felt like it was like warding off a lot of just frustration and heat and heat. Testosterone makes you very warm. I feel like I'm sweaty all the time now. But a lot of different compounding factors, I think, in my experience, probably led to a little bit of these larger issues I saw come out. And I was also being hyper vigilant going through school and learning about these things, that this is what was going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More awareness on your part. So then what else with medical transition?
So I have also had top surgery, which for me was a bilateral mastectomy with nipple graft replacements. So which wasn't covered by insurance, I think is something important for people to know, that my insurance did not cover any gender reaffirming surgeries or anything like that. So I was really lucky to have my medical team be in this nonprofit sector that allowed me to still get that care. But my top surgery was out of pocket, and it was like about $8,500 that I had to pay for by myself. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, figured out how to do that. But that is a bit of a large feat for people to come up with that kind of money. Mm-hmm. And is a lot of factors of people having access to this absolutely necessary and life-changing surgery. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that I don't know if I'll ever like come to terms with, that insurance can just like pick and choose to not cover gender affirming, you know, care. But that's unfortunately the reality that I was met with until I changed my insurance companies, but made it very difficult to get access to the absolutely necessary medical care.
Because some do, right? Like, I think I heard recently that Starbucks in particular has very good insurance for this.
Yes, and actually a lot of transgender people end up working at Starbucks knowing that, because their gender reaffirming care on their insurance is impeccable. So if anyone needs to know where to work for that, Starbucks.
It was not an affiliate, by the way. It was the podcast. But
right. Starbucks sponsored me.
It was that, it was that webinar last night. It was like all over, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they have, so there's a couple of plans that have like 100% coverage and are really involved in, and have it, but in some have none, like mine did.
Anything specific in terms of kind of after that surgery that OT practitioners might need or address?
Mm-hmm. So there are limitations after surgery. There's no overhead lifting or any sort of overhead movement for 6 to 8 weeks, I believe. So getting dressed, I was literally like, wow, this is why it's so hard to get dressed and why these dressing techniques are so important, and like knowing to adjust dressing. And then there is a significant amount of scar care after surgery. So I did a lot of scar management, 3-4 times a day, every day for a year and a half. I did scar management, which is a little more excessive than most people, but I was very actively working towards diminishing my scars, but using things like silicone and bio oil and different mechanisms to help that scar, because they're giant scars. They're 8 or 9 inch scars, two across the front of my chest. And I've had moments of like catching or uncomfortable movements because that scar fibers haven't quite broken down all the way. So I was very fortunate to have a fieldwork placement that taught me all about scar management right before I had surgery.
So that was going to be my question. Did you do scar management because someone on the clinical team said something, or were you doing it because
you had OT knowledge?
My OT knowledge and a little bit of having that be introduced to me from my surgeon. Okay. So he was very on top of his results and checking in and making sure people were happy and had different products for us to use. But that mostly was the OT inside of me who's very interested in scar management and learning all about it so that I can use it in my future care.
In my head, I just have this mental list of things going of like why OT should be part of the clinical care team.
And at any point during your medical transition, did you have any experience with an OT?
No.
Because like, and a lot of the things that you're talking about and describing, like especially like the issues with dressing, like how perfect and appropriate is that in a time for an OT to come in and talk about these adapted dressing techniques? You know, and I almost feel like the big question is like, how does OT then get into this and help individuals during this time?
How do we get our foot
in the door? Yeah. Which is a great question. I do know that OT does come in on the clinical care team later down the line. So if I was ever interested in pursuing bottom surgery, there is a giant skin graft that's taken from your arm. So then you go to OT for fine motor and scar management when you take a giant graft off of the arm. So they're in there. So we need to slowly trickle down from the top of this and get into other places and other surgeries, maybe the less quote unquote intense surgeries, but moving down that realm.
Because I think that comes to like, you know, OT is so much more than fine motor skills. I think these other activities of daily living and these other aspects that, you know.
To me, if you're a student in an OTD program right now, or if you're a capstone coordinator, you have anything to do with those OTD capstones, you need to think about finding in your community where that clinical care team is and making some phone calls and say, hey, can I come in education and maybe do some program planning or like a needs assessment, something.
And it would be interesting too for like an OT to run a community group with other transgender people so that there's a sense of community and learning and growing within that area too. I think there's so many different areas that they could move in into the clinical realm.
So on that note, and I wish I came prepared with stats, but the stats aren't great when it comes to suicide rates and just anything related to mental health. What are your thoughts on that in terms of what OT can come in and do?
Yeah, I'm very, very happy you brought that up because that was something I absolutely wanted to touch on. So unfortunately, the statistics right now are that 42% of trans people kill themselves. Which hits us at almost 1 in 2. And that means that like at any point throughout all of this care, the care you're providing is suicide prevention. Using people's correct name is suicide prevention. Using correct pronouns is suicide prevention. Your ability to respect your clients and respect your patients and their wishes is suicide prevention, and that knowing how genuinely important it is as a holistic practice and in what we really believe in as OTs is that this interaction might be the only interaction all week where the patient's being respected and called the right names or being addressed by the right pronouns, which might be just enough to get someone to the next day. Like, I will never forget going into a pharmacy early on in my transition and just being up to, like, way in over my head, way, way too much. And when the pharmacy said, "How are you doing today, sir?" that got me to the next day. And so that simple interaction is all I needed to get me to the next day. And if I had had, you know, an OT or someone like, well, my clinical care team did respect me at all points throughout it, but that being addressed by your name and your pronouns is so important to who someone is and to be validated, especially when they're not getting validation from anywhere else. And that also there's going to be a lot of other components of working with gender variant individuals, because there is a higher rate of depression and anxiety and substance abuse in the community to cope and overcome with these extreme stressors that come with transitioning. And I think OT has a role in that emotional role in learning new coping mechanisms and learning new ways to adjust to all this stress and these new, what is it even called? Like, I, like this new space in the world that I'm taking up. Like, I lost a lot of privilege by deciding to transition, in the world in a very macro level, since it's being debated, you know, across governmental levels. My healthcare has been affected. A lot of human rights are being affected, and coping with this stress that we talk about that a lot of minority groups do encounter, that we have a role to step in there and try to help and help close those gaps and move them down. But mostly to respect and appreciate our patients for where they're at and who they are and what they need from us, which is usually a little bit of validation.
Yeah. Which is the, should be, we forget the core of our profession sometimes and treat, you know, that occupational justice and everybody having access to participation.
Yeah.
Do you, what do you think, not just OT wise, but in terms of healthcare practitioners as a whole, we can do to get better with pronouns?
Very good question. I think something that I had to even do myself was, especially practicing they, them pronouns, and just, I would like to look in the mirror and say, well, they wanted to go to the store today, or just sentences that incorporated it in using it over and over and over and over again. And that, you know, it might not be something that you understand or get if they use maybe a different pronoun or something that's variant outside of he, him, she, her, they, them. They might use a different pronoun or something. It's not necessarily our job to understand it, but it is our job to respect it, and that you just have to put in the time and effort to make sure that you're using those appropriate pronouns. So if you have to say in the mirror 100 times, you know, whoever's name, then he, and just making that association and making that link so that it's not like disconnected, if that makes sense.
It does make sense.
Yeah.
And that's really good advice, because I think that is still very new to most OT practitioners and healthcare practitioners.
Right. And I think it's hard to, sometimes people don't exactly know where they fall on that line yet, what they want to be called. And so it makes it a little difficult for people to know how to address someone, but it's just making sure every day that you're trying to be better.
Yeah.
And that knowing that there like has to be a level that you respect someone, like that can't be go up or down based on the situation, that fluctuation level. And that if you're having a problem with that cultural competency in the moment, that it is 100% your responsibility and duty to that patient to start doing your own research and start learning how to close those bridges in your own life to make sure you're giving like clinically excellent care.
Yeah. I'm glad you used cultural competence because that's what it is.
Yep.
And people need to recognize that, that's what this comes down to, is being culturally competent, which we should all be striving to do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
I have, yeah. I don't know about you, JJ. I have one final question, which is,
go ahead.
What advice do you have for people, students, practitioners who just want more information? Is it the same question as you?
You read my mind.
who want more information, don't know where to go, want to learn more about not just transgender and anything, but we'll talk transgender. And like, we very much focused, obviously, on female to male. There's a whole different side of things. What's your advice to practitioners and students for where to get information?
Great question. A really great place to start is seeing if there's any sort of LGBT center or group or anything like that in the area. So a lot of major cities will have some sort of LGBT place where you can go and start learning more. I definitely would say the internet is a wonderful place. You can find a lot of information from some of our bigger names like PFLAG, or what else? There's just, it's kind of hard because it's been so long since I've researched and thought about this. But really just trying to do that due diligence of going down the research rabbit holes and, okay, well, I found this. Where am I going next? What's my next question? What am I looking for and looking to understand next? But I think the most important thing for me to emphasize today to students and other practitioners is that the respect and care that you give a transgender person will be felt deeper and more intensely than probably a lot of other interactions. A slip up in name or pronouns is detrimental. And so in order to truly be working with this population that is at such a high risk for suicide, you do need to understand that your words and actions are suicide prevention. And that is an important part of taking care of these patients in these very, very vulnerable places that might not be getting it from home or friends or family or anything like that. And that it is just so important to keep researching and keep digging and keep researching to make sure you are providing what this person needs.
I can't think of a better place to end.
I'll say, I think that's a very, very powerful statement. Yeah. And very beautifully said.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gavin, so much for being on OT After Dark. This was a fabulous experience and a wonderful, wonderful episode. And again, thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so happy to be back to recording.
Oh, it just feels so good. It
feels good.
Yeah.
We'll try. We'll try to keep it up. But it's a pandemic still.
Bear with us a little bit.
We still have a lot going on. But today was great. So much gratitude to Gavin for sharing his lived experience.
So many powerful points, I think, that he brought up, especially what's really going to stick with me is that suicide prevention and how important every interaction is when working with individuals.
No matter how seemingly small that interaction is, that we need to maintain that cultural competence with people. We have some organizations to share.
So as Gavin had mentioned, you know, if you're interested in more information, reach out to your local LGBTQ centers in your area. We'll also have some links to some other organizations on our website, such as PFLAG, the Trevor Project, GLAAD, the National Center for Transgender Equality, Human Rights Campaign, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association, our friends at Gender Spectrum, and also the World Professional Association for Transgender Health.
And on that note, don't forget, sex is an ADL.
Cheers!